Now, gambling has always been a huge part of Irish sport. If people like you and me enjoy the occasional bet on matches, then why should we be surprised if the people who play sport also like a flutter? But what was once seen as harmless fun is now finally being recognised as a growing crisis. Problem gambling, it turns out, is 6 times more prevalent among GAA players than the rest of the population. It's News Talk Daily. I'm Tara Duggan. For years, gambling wasn't something openly talked about in dressing rooms, but over the past decade, more players have come forward with their stories of how gambling addictions took hold, often starting with a punt on a match at the weekend. At the same time, research is warning about the scale of the problem in Irish society and how young men who play sports are particularly at risk. Today we're hearing two perspectives, one from someone who's lived it, Armagh footballer Oisín McConville, who's spoken openly about his addiction and the long road back from it. And one from the research side. Dr. Kieran Murray has just completed a detailed study looking specifically at gambling addiction within GAA players, and what he found is stark to say the least. Players who feel pressure to perform, pressure to socialise, pressure to fit in, often end up carrying secret debts and a level of shame that keeps them silent. So today we're asking, what does gambling addiction look like behind the scenes of a team environment? How widespread is the issue and what needs to change? Let's hear first from Dr. Kieran Murray. Kieran is a consultant rheumatologist and associate professor at the University of Limerick. But if you're a Limerick football fan, well, then you may have also seen him line out on occasion for Mungret St. Paul's. Kieran, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thanks very much.
Now, can I start with that statistic I mentioned there in the intro to the podcast, this high rate of gambling among elite GAA players? The figure informs the new research published in the Irish Journal of Medical Science. You've been warning about the emergence of this gambling culture and problem gambling culture within the GAA for some time.
Thanks very much again for having me today. And I'd just like to thank all of the co-authors on this and also the GPA and the WGPA at the time who are really supportive of this. So essentially, I think what you're referring to there is that figure where problem gambling in Ireland is 0.8%. And then in our study, we found it was 4.8%. So yes, 6 times more likely. And yes, there is one of the things that came across is kind of a gambling culture in sport. And this kind of goes, you know, the whole way from gambling sponsorship of competitions and top tier sports team. For example, when you're 45% of Premier League teams are sponsored by gambling companies, right down to, you know, a gambling culture in individual teams in the dressing rooms.
Before we go on, Kieran, many people listening will say, sure, look, you know, what harm is it to have an occasional bet? We might take a flutter on the horses or scratch a few lottery tickets here and there. There's no harm in it. But really, what are the dangers that lurk there within gambling as you see it?
Well, gambling now, you know, has been coded, has like a DSM code for a medical illness, and it's widespread harms in terms of mental health issues, in particular suicidality, etc. So, like, you know, I think we probably have enough research now that we can't really just dismiss it at this stage.
And I mean, you mentioned sponsorship, gambling sponsorship of sports events and of teams there. But in a general sense, do you think sports people maybe themselves are a little bit more vulnerable? They would be, I suppose, competitive by nature?
Yes. So, you know, I think it's important to recognise that the GAA has also banned all gambling sponsorship of sports. And that's shown real leadership when we compare it to other sporting organisations. And numerous studies have shown that athletes are more prone to addictive gambling behaviours. And there seems to be a couple of reasons before that. One is they feel, you know, they may have a knowledge of the sport, somewhat giving them a competitive advantage. Two, there's a theory out there that, you know, in the off season and sitting on buses and during downtime when they're injured, that it kind of can provide that dopamine hit that, you know, you may get kind of playing elite sports in stadiums, etc. And three, you know, as I was mentioning there, that gambling culture. So that was something that came across quite strongly in some of the kind of player statements, how, you know, they may be on one team where gambling was never talked about, and they may be on another team where, you know, people are kind of comparing online bets at the back of a bus.
And is that leadership, where you'd have maybe it would be endemic in one team but not in another? Does that stem from the leadership of the team?
I think some of that is cultural. You know, in our study, and I think this is quite a stark fact, all of the problem gamblers were male. So, you know, it does seem to be quite a cultural thing in that, you know, perhaps in male cultures, they're kind of maybe more of a pattern towards that risk-taking behavior. Whereas another segment of the study looked at problem alcohol use. And, you know, that was much more kind of evenly distributed between males and females.
Interesting. And we're talking specifically about the GAA here, but do you have figures that would compare it with maybe elite athletes who are, you know, rugby, soccer, horse racing itself, for example? I'm just curious because gambling, it strikes me. I mean, it's harmful, and I think it's pretty clear that problem gambling is very harmful. In the GAA, they're volunteer sports, you know, whereas other sports are being paid and in many cases very handsomely paid.
So it's been shown in a wide range of sports, you know, both at elite level and then even to collegiate sports. For example, in the US, there was studies looking at high level athletes there. So, you know, it's widespread, and the numbers may be different in terms of how much players are betting. For example, Premier League soccer players would have far larger salaries. But, you know, it does seem a cultural issue widespread amongst, you know, many team sports and ball sports. This has been replicated in studies in other countries. So, you know, it's not a uniquely Irish phenomenon. And I don't think this is a GAA-specific issue.
Mm-hmm. Or even an Irish-specific issue because, no. You know, we have a close tradition here in this country with horse racing and with dog racing as well, you know?
Yeah, and that's horse racing. Really, gambling is kind of part of the financial viability of that sport in Ireland at the moment. So, you know, that is something that would need to be looked at.
And do you know, do athletes tend to stick with betting within their own sport? Or, you know, is a GAA player as likely to be betting on the outcome of a horse race or a Premier League football fixture?
They have been shown to bet on their own sports, but also widespread. And obviously, you know, betting on your own sport may carry other caveats in terms of you know, potentially influencing the outcome of events, etc.
Mm. And what do the athletes you've spoken to and the GAA players specifically that you've spoken to for your research, what do they tell you? What are their own perceptions of gambling and their own gambling issues?
And the most common kind of comment that came through was the significant harms of gambling. So an example of that would be, I believe gambling is a bigger issue in the GAA than I'd initially thought. I'm not a gambler, nor can I understand the pull that it has, but I've seen firsthand about 5 to 10% of an average squad, the impact and hold it has and the reluctance of players to admit or embrace help. And the ease of online apps, etc., a real curse. The next most common theme was how it was an issue amongst GAA players. So gambling can depend on team culture. I've been part of a lot of teams, some where everybody places bets, some where lads would bet every single day, and other teams where almost nobody would gamble or throw down a bet here and there. So players were generally in agreement with the GAA's decision to prohibit sponsorship in 2018. Great decision to ban sponsorship. The sponsorship in soccer is disgraceful and something that causes a lot of trouble. Next was individual responsibility. So that was 5 out of the 68 respondents. You can't blame bookies for people's inability to control themselves. It's like blaming McDonald's for an overweight population. The next was education about gambling required. Was a compulsive gambler, but haven't gambled in almost 3 years. GA could do more to educate people in terms of damage in the future, for example, bad credit ratings.
So it seems they're under no illusions themselves. They see the harm. Words like a curse and addiction and affliction are cropping up there. So they can clearly see that, or some of them, or many of them at least. What about education and treatment? What is there in place to support GAA players who are having a problem and are struggling with addiction, gambling?
Well, in fairness, at the elite level, you know, formerly the WGPA and the GPA have now merged, you know, have put in structures in place in terms of, you know, anonymous helplines, etc. And we've been liaising with Dr. O'Gara as well, who's a specialist in the field of this, you know, kind of looking at putting specific products in place to try and help people with gambling issues. And then also you've got healthy club committees, etc.
And what role do community organisations, including GAA clubs and the grassroots movement, what role can they realistically play in prevention and support and cure?
I mean, I think they can play a huge role in, you know, initially kind of highlighting this as an issue. And, you know, people are really invested in their own clubs and their communities. You know, it's their kind of children and relatives, etc. And I think they can show real leadership there. And then, you know, all of the inter-county players who you know, you might argue have this kind of more extended reach, that they're also club players and members of the community. So, you know, I do think there's kind of real practical implications there.
Kieran Murray, thank you very much for joining us on News Talk Daily today.
Thanks very much for having me.
And now we're joined by Armagh football star Oisín McConville, who hid a severe gambling addiction during the peak of his playing career. It began innocently enough, Oisín, but escalated fairly quickly once he started earning money. Is that right?
Yeah, Tara. I suppose I started gambling at 14, so I would say I wasn't making too many informed decisions at 14 years of age, but look, it was harmless. I walked into the bookmakers was packed. It was the local bookmakers. This was late 80s, so like they weren't the plush surroundings that they are now. It was a smoke-filled room at the back of a pub, basically, but I was instantly attracted to everything that was going on in there. It didn't matter what the size of the bets or anything else, but that soon escalated, as you say, and I tried to recreate the buzz that I was getting on a football pitch in the bookies. To begin with, as I say, that was small amounts of money, but that soon increased and continued to increase. So too did the time, and so too did the things I was willing to do in order to feed my addiction. And I suppose gambling for a lot of people is an addiction that doesn't really have a massive amount of understanding. But I mean, I was getting a serious buzz out of it. And I thought when I started gambling that the possibilities were endless. So like I was very much into material things at that time, you know, or the possibility of material things. Like, you know, like when I gambled, I wanted the new football boots to begin with, then it was the new cars or houses or whatever it happened to be. But those material things then really meant very little in the end. And for I think about my last 4 years of my gambling, and there was no buzz. There was no buzz from winning or losing or anything else, but I couldn't arrest it at that stage because I was in the midst of a gambling addiction. Compulsive gamblers or compulsive liars, and I was stuck in the midst of like my life at that stage was complete carnage. Suicidal thoughts. I had a plan on how, you know, I was going to carry that out, and I thought that was more reasonable to take my own life than to actually admit to another human being. And when I say that today, obviously that fills me full of dread. Like if my son came to me and said that was how he felt, I mean, that would fill me full of dread and sadness. But that was the way I felt at that time, and that is one of the reasons why I suppose I have had the long-term recovery that I've had, because as I said, that particularly scared me when I did think back on it.
Now, talk to me a little about the money, the debts, the overdrafts, the constantly robbing Peter to pay Paul, you know, the borrowing, the having to explain to people why you couldn't pay them back.
Yeah, like it like that was a big part of why I ended up holding my hands up as well, was because I couldn't stand the pressure of that anymore. Begging, borrowing, stealing, hooking, scamming, scheming, had a huge amount of debt. But I suppose I wasn't really living in reality, in that when letters came to the house, I just ripped them up and threw them in the bin because I didn't want to know exactly how much I owed. Like, I mean, I was living in a fantasy world. I thought maybe, you know, at the end of my gambling that maybe if I owed 30,000 or 40,000, and it was, I think it was more like 5-6 times that. But, you know, I had trained myself in my head to think, you know what, this is actually not that bad, I can keep going. And then the harsh reality of it all was that, you know, I was financially bankrupt, emotionally bankrupt, and I had, it was a long path back to redemption. But my family guaranteed a loan for me. My sister looked after all my finances for the next 5.5 years, and I set about paying that debt back. And I suppose, lucky enough, I felt as if I had done the crime, but I'd also done the time in paying all the individuals back, and the credit cards and the banks and everything else. And I was lucky that I had some support around me at that stage. My family supported me through all that time, consolidated a loan for me, and as I say, I paid that back. You know, I was working 6.5 days a week. I was playing football. I didn't have any life, and it was a very, very simple life, and I really enjoyed that at that stage because my life before that had become so complicated.
Yeah, complicated and chaotic. What was the most amount of money you lost in one go?
£20,000 was the second last bet I had on a horse.
And how did that feel? I mean, when you were handing over that money to make the bet, did you have a sense of fear and dread, or were you still at that point, like gamblers will tell themselves, this is the big one, this is the one?
The build up to that, That's exactly the way I felt. The build-up was, you know, this is the big one. I'm gonna win £100,000. I'm gonna pay off everybody owe, and I'm gonna start my life all over again without gambling. Now that was never gonna happen, but that's what I was telling myself. But when I actually placed the bet, I had no emotion. It didn't faze me whether the horse won or lost, or like obviously the horse lost, but it didn't faze me in any way. Obviously, I didn't feel happy about it, but I definitely didn't feel sad either. You know what I mean? Gambling and addiction had stripped me of all emotion. My father had died in 1980. I had no tears for my father. The first time I cried as a result of my father's death was 2006, when I actually came out of treatment, because as I say, I was devoid of any sort of emotion. So I was emotionless with the second last bet. Like my last bet, believe it or not, was £6. I went out in the car and got £6 thinking I'd win all the money back. Now, I know that sounds insane, but that seemed quite logical to me at that time.
Where your head with that?
It was, yeah.
And was that your rock bottom?
I had several rock bottoms. I had several false dawns, several times where I said to myself, that's it, you know, this is not sustainable, can't keep it going. And I suppose that was the most recent rock bottom. But the accumulation of so many days where, you know, you feel there was a lot of self-loathing, you feel suicidal, all those things. So it was a culmination of all of those things adding up over time. But I suppose if you want to call it my rock bottom, yeah, that was probably my rock bottom. But I had a few before that, but I hadn't asked for help. The difference this time was that I actually stuck my hand up and asked people would they help me.
And what was that first conversation like? Who was it with?
It was my sister and my brother, and it was a very, very, very tough conversation. Because not only was I admitting to them, but I was saying it out loud, so I was sort of admitting it to myself. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. You know, out loud. I'd always had those internal thoughts where I thought, you know, I really need to get my act together. I really need to admit this to somebody else. But that was the first time I'd voiced it and said it out loud. So there was a huge amount of shame because, you know, the deaths were huge. And the damage was huge. The damage to people around me. Because when I started gambling, I thought, well, I'm only doing myself harm. You know what I mean? So it's not the end of the world. Whereas in actual fact, like, I was hurting all of those people around me, realistically.
You underwent treatment at Coon Wirra.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Went into Coon Wirra again, you know, the pride thing, walking in through the doors. I suppose I would have been well known, if you want, in the GAA circles. You know what the GA is like as far as society goes. So whenever I went in there, a lot of people recognized me. So I had to get over that pride bit initially. But like the help I got in there, I suppose I was 29 years of age, but I had no self-awareness around addiction. I thought to be addicted, you had to be laying on a park bench with a bottle of wine and a brown background. Like when somebody said to me I was addicted, like I said, whoa, hold on a second, you might be going a bit too far. So even though I was in the depths of despair, the first person that mentioned me being addicted was a nun. And like, you shouldn't be cursing at nuns and that, but I really despise that word. And I suppose very quickly I realized that I was the archetypal person who would be in addiction. I fitted all the bills, and I was finding it very difficult to hold my hands up. But once I did, then once I surrendered to it, things got better from there. I spent 13 weeks in that treatment center, and I come out in February 2005. I went straight to my father's grave. I cried. I went to people that I owed money to, and I told them that they would get their money back and where I had been and all of those things. And you know what? The response and support I got from people and being able to pay those people back, it was very satisfying at the time because, as I say, any little thing that boosted my confidence at that time to get me back on track was huge.
You work now with people in addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I work in intervention. I'm the ambassador for gamblingcare.ie, and there's a huge amount of work going on. I suppose the work that really interests me is not just people who find themselves in trouble, but education to young people. And also, I suppose, we have a regulator now. You know, those enforcements are going to be coming together in the next, hopefully, 18 months. So I think that's going to make a huge difference to the landscape, to the people who are struggling and the people who are susceptible. And the people, I suppose, there's a whole new demographic that has been introduced to gambling. And I suppose It's trying to take care of those who are most vulnerable and most predisposed to being a problem gambler. And I think the regulator, the legislation, gambling care, if we all are working in the same way, I do think we can make a dent in this thing. But like, it is like a runaway train right now. It's going to be very hard to play catch up.
A runaway train that, as we heard from Kieran, disproportionately affects young male athletes and disproportionately affects in particular young male GAA players. Does it shock you to see that that's still the case?
So Tara, in England, they did a survey in 2019 around professional athletes, and professional athletes were, or those who play a competitive sport were twice as likely to become compulsive gamblers. Those who play a competitive team sport were three times more likely. So the figures released on GAA players do not surprise me at all. I think a lot of GAA lads now, for a fair part of the season, are not socialising. The intercounty lads in particular, they're not drugging because they know they're going to be tested, and they pick up gambling as something which is quite harmless. And for a lot of people, it is quite harmless to begin with, but once it gets in on you and once it becomes an addiction, I mean, the stark figures for me are, for every 8 people that begin gambling, 1 will gamble compulsively. So the figures themselves around competitiveness, trying to beat the bookie, boredom, not socializing, not probably living in the same way as other people are in general society. But look, there's a massive problem with gambling in our society. And let's face it, the GAA reflects everything that's going on in society. So it doesn't shock me at all that there's a massive issue. And that in particular, it's affecting lads who are playing competitive team sport. And also, interestingly, starting to infiltrate into females as well. You know, women between the ages of 25 and 45, that's the biggest influx of people into Gamblers Anonymous and problem gambling.
Oshima Conville and Kieran Murray, thank you both very much for being here on News Talk Daily. If you've any concerns about your own gambling habits and would like some help and information, well, we've included some helpful links in the show notes. That's it for today's podcast. Thank you very much for your company. I'll be here with another edition of News Talk Daily tomorrow morning. Talk to you then.